with the second part of this lecture series. So Greg Rodatze again is here from New York University, and he will tell us some more about classical gravity. We don't have a strict time limit after this. Well, Greg is leaving at 5:30, so that's a couple.
We can get the curve.
Huh?
We can get the curve.
Yeah. Well, if someone wants to hold Greg or otherwise just skate, maybe that will work. But that means that feel free to interject your questions as much as you like, but let's do try to keep the questions to on topic.
Okay. So let me summarize what we've done in the previous lecture. So we developed the decoupling limit method, and we tried to apply it to massive gravity. And we said that if you choose generic coefficients in your expansion in your fields, you would get in trouble because of some specific nature of the high-dimensional nonlinear terms, which have more than two time derivatives in the equations of motion. And then I also said that there exists a choice for those coefficients so that you never get more than two time derivatives in your decoupling limit theory. And let me give you now the sufficient condition for that to happen. If I call U the potential for the gravitational Lagrangian, so U is the function of the fields, everything except the Einstein-Hilbert term in the Lagrangian, okay? So then that U taken at h equals to zero, a equals to zero, which leaves it as a function of pi, this has to be a total derivative. So for sure, this is a sufficient condition. Back then, we didn't know that it turns out also to be necessary. So this was proven by Mehrdad Mirbabai later on, as I mentioned. But let me continue with the sufficiency. This is very strong condition on the potential, because in any number of dimensions, you only have a few total derivatives that you can construct of single scalar field entering with two derivatives. Remember, this pi always enters as dd pi. That's just part of the construction. It has this Galilean symmetry. And all the terms have to have dd pis or powers of dd pi. And then you can only have a few total derivatives like that in your theory. So let me write them explicitly. So I introduce the notation that a capital pi mu nu equals to d mu d nu pi. And then the total derivatives, except the linear trivial one that I can write, are this. So u2 is going to be box pi square minus dd pi square. This is what we used already in First Pauli. And let me rewrite this in terms of epsilon tensor. There's epsilon mu, epsilon nu pi mu nu. Dots means that these are indices constructed with each other. And mu index is, and the mu and nu indices are constructed with capital pi's. In which here, this is just d mu d nu pi squared. Okay, so you can rewrite in terms of this. And u3 is box pi cube minus, there is 3 box pi dd pi square plus 2 box pi cube, which is proportional to epsilon mu alpha rho epsilon nu beta sigma. Like that. And then there is the last one, u4, we call it. So, which is hard to write in terms of this, but easy to write in terms of the epsilon tensors. This is just epsilon mu alpha rho lambda epsilon mu beta sigma tau pi mu pi alpha beta pi rho sigma pi lambda tau.
Are there terms at all possible with an odd number of epsilons?
No, these are the only ones.
But but these are even number of epsilons.
Well, I do have to think in terms of epsilons. You see, so you list all possible total derivatives, let's say in this form. So you have powers of d d pi contracted one way or other, and you list all of them. And then you try to construct how many of them you can have. So even in that language, you can only have 2, 3, and 4. There is also 1, which is just box pi. But then you can rewrite this in terms of epsilons. That's what I'm saying. This rewriting is just convenient and suggestive, because this tells you why you cannot have more than that. You cannot saturate more indices.
But I think in terms of just, if you add odd number of epsilons, they will vanish, right? Because pi mu nu is symmetric.
Yeah,
you could entertain some more complicated combinations, but they won't be total derivatives. Yeah. So that's it. So then this is the sufficient and turns out necessary condition for the absence of all those bad nonlinear terms that I mentioned. So once you require this, it fixes for you C1, C2, C3 in terms of just one C3. And you know, D1 to D5 in terms of just one D5, so you have one freedom in the cubic order and one freedom in the quartic order, and that's it. Okay. And using this, you can now derive the full Lagrangian, and the full Lagrangian in the decoupling limit is this. This is lambda 2, as usual. Okay. Yeah, let me write it explicitly. There is usual Einstein-Hilbert part. And then H nu nu couples to sum of what we call X mu nu. And then there is a... So this is all except the vector mode. Remember, vector mode I'm not considering because it has its own U1, hence you know that it has 2 degrees of freedom already. So you want to have 2 degrees of freedom in H mu nu and just 1 degree of freedom in pi, and that's the right counting. But you know, you also have expression in terms of the vector, in fact. So where X mu nu's are very special tensors made of pi, which are kinematically conserved. So this tensor we've already seen in the Fitts-Pauli Lagrangian. It's kinematically conserved. If you hit it with derivative, it's zero automatically. So these are something like topological currents in terms of you don't need equations of motion for them to be conserved. And it's important that you only couple those kind of things to H mu nu, because that's what enforces the gauge invariance. So there is a diff invariance for H linear difference for H mu nu, hence you know that H mu nu propagates 2 degrees of freedom. Right? So let me rewrite this in terms of epsilons again. So this can be rewritten as epsilon mu alpha dot dot epsilon nu beta dot dot pi alpha beta. And then there is X mu nu 3, which I won't write in this form, but in epsilon 4 is very easy. Epsilon mu 3. And then there is the last one. So this was X2. And this is X mu nu 3. And that's it. You cannot write more again because you saturate all the indices. This also tells you that if you go to different dimensionalities, what you get. So let's say you go to 3 dimensions. In 3 dimensions, X3 doesn't exist. You'll get only X1 and X2. And if you go to 5 dimensions, you will have one more term, etc. So this is a universal structure for all the dimensions, in fact. But in 4 dimensions, these are the only ones that you have. And then you can ask what's the freedom in terms of the parameters. So A1 here is just 1. That's just a normalization of the mass term. Okay? But then there is A2 and A3, which are related to the C3 and D5 coefficients that I was using before. A3 is C3 plus 8D5. I don't know if this is visible. But so basically, if you don't count the master or mass as a parameter, you have two parameter family of Lagrangians, and that is all. So it terminates at that level. So there is no higher order anymore. So it's exactly the decoupling limit for these modes, helicity 2 and helicity 0. All right, so I'm going to do two things. First is, I'm going to deduce, of course, the full nonlinear Lagrangian, but then analyze full nonlinear Lagrangian. But also, in terms of this Lagrangian, you can already study cosmology, because as I said, decoupling limit corresponds to being at scales which are much smaller than inverse M and being in the regime of weak gravity. So if you don't care about black holes and if you don't care about near the horizon physics, this is a good approximation. So you can describe cosmology as small departure from Minkowski space, in fact. Of course, for the black holes, you would have to have the full Lagrangian to which I come. Now, before I discuss the cosmology of this, let me just make a comment on relation of this with the Galilean, what's called the Galilean theories. Turns out that you can diagonalize this except the last term. So this x3 times h is not diagonalizable by any local transformations, but h times x1 and x2 are diagonalizable. And when you diagonalize, you get exactly those Galileans that people have been discussing in a different context. So the Galileans are the nonlinear terms which are only these two derivative equations. They turn out to be part of this. They come out naturally in this context. Now, you may want to go to that language or not go to that language, it's a matter of choice, but it's part of it. So, if I have extra time, then I'll discuss some relevant issues, such as absence or presence of superluminarity, etc., which were discussed in the context of Galileans versus here. But let me move on with cosmology first.
Before you do that, though, yes. You said there are symmetries that forbid things like higher derivative of phi,
There is a Galilean, what's called the Galilean symmetry, which is pi can go to pi plus v mu times x mu plus c. So c is a constant and v mu is a constant vector. So this is a symmetry of this Lagrangian.
X is a coordinate.
X is a coordinate. Now, this forbids d pi to the fourth or terms like this. It doesn't forbid, though, terms like bad terms, which I started with. So that's why you have to have those tuning of the coefficients, if you will, or those choices of the coefficients for the theory to be propagating just 5 degrees of freedom, not 6. And there is a whole story in how you can see that there is only 2-time derivatives here that's straightforward in the Galilean language or in this language. Because of these epsilon structures, you never get more than 2-time derivative. So basically, it has something to do with epsilons. I won't go into that discussion. It's straightforward.
So I'm a bit confused. So the Galilean is not a total derivative. Galilean action is not a total derivative. But these guys are total derivatives.
No, these are not. So action is h mu times this.
Which is a total derivative.
No, it's not. What I was saying is that the criterion for constructing good theory, which is that one, is that if I take my potential of gravity and in its substitute h equals 0 and a equals 0, the helicity 1, then the terms that remain should be total derivatives.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Now, those total derivatives exist here. I could add those total derivatives here, but I'm ignoring them because they are total derivatives. And besides total derivatives, you get terms which are nullified in that substitution, right? These terms would be zero in that substitution because h is zero. So this is the essence of the theory, if you want. Total derivative is like some topology or something. This is the dynamics.
What stops us writing down something with h squared and x?
H squared with x is that in the decoupling limit, you don't get h squared terms because they're down by extra powers of 1 O.M. Planck if you restore. In the decoupling limit, you don't have them. In full theory, you will, of course.
And the thing is, when you did the non-gravity case, the decoupling limit was e goes to 0, m goes to 0.
Yes.
And we knew how to build
that.
In that case, it was m goes to 0, right?
It's there is an analogy here, which is m goes to 0 here as well. But and a coupling constant, which is inverse Planck, also goes to 0 because Planck goes to infinity.
But my question was going to be was that in the gauge case, if the rules were I build E's as coefficients and I make my dimensions all m's, then I have a rule that tells me if lambda is fixed, which one of the things to keep which
oh,
one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of
if
course.
You don't tell me that rule, then I can just
put
it anywhere I want,
right? Well, the rule has to come out naturally. It's not that I impose it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important question, yes. So by canceling this by this requirement, okay, I cancel all the terms which are bound by what's called the lambda 5 scale. Okay, so if I had terms bound by this scale, those would be the bad terms because you can do power counting. Okay, this requirement cancels them automatically to all orders, and then what remains are the terms which are done by this scale instead, and that's the scale that you fix that you keep fixed in the decoupling limit.
But if I start off writing the original Lagrange before I start doing the coupling limit,
right.
Was the rule that I suppress all the scales and denominators are m planks, and all the scales and numerators are little m's, or I have an m for every pi or something like that?
No, you follow very strict rules, which is that you wrote down the polynomial. This is a polynomial of this capital H.
Yeah, and that involves m planks.
That involves, in front of it, it involves, yeah, m Planck, there is m Planck square, m square in front, that's it. So, square root of g, capital H square, capital H cube. There is no scale here because these are dimensionless objects. Okay?
So then now, I just take little m's where they come from H and then I
right,
just...
so then the strict rule is that when I expand in terms of these helicity states, those helicity states have to have canonically normalized kinetic terms. Like I did for the Fritz Pauli. That prescribes how I should be scaling those fields which enter in the expression for H. Then there is no choice. I get what I get with those scalings because I've normalized canonically my kinetic terms. And there is no choice for the interaction terms. So some interaction terms could come suppressed by this scale, and some could come suppressed with this scale. Now, ones that come suppressed with this scale are bad. They give rise to Boulevard Desert Ghost. That's why this choice, which eliminates all those terms, and then you are left with terms which are suppressed by this lambda 3.
And is anything that's built with H invariant with this Galilean symmetry? So there's no symmetry restrictions on the Lagrange in this chunk of H?
Well, there is linearized diffs.
Yeah, but just that.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to take a term that you did not write down and ask how big is it, like something involving an extra derivative or something,
you mean derivative of the capital H?
Yeah.
Well, that won't be that will modify one modification of the Einstein part. So you can.
Which has to happen at some level, right? Because Einstein is not
linear. Sure. I mean, first of all, there is a redundancy. Those kind of terms can be up to a certain level. They can be removed by doing some nonlinear field definition in the Einstein part.
Yeah.
So the ones that are not removed, they are in this limit. They scale with higher powers. So they are.
But the rule for them would be that I just stick an m Planck square and I need them to make dimensions work.
Right.
I don't put in little m's to make them work.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So in this regard, I should have said that these are a 2 is down by lambda 3 cube and this is down by lambda 3 6. Okay, so then so let's do some cosmology with that Lagrangian. If I take variation, I have to do variation with respect to h mu nu and pi. And if I do variation with respect to h mu nu, I'm going to get linearized Einstein tensor. And then I'm going to get something that we can call just x mu nu of pi. And this would be T mu nu, whatever T mu nu we introduced of matter. So then you see that even if you don't introduce T mu nu, you have some effective energy momentum tensor in your theory, which is due to this helicity zero. So there is some new fluid, if you want to regard that way, which is in the decoupling limit, it makes sense to think this way. So new fluid due to these pi's. And it has some energy momentum tensor to which you know, gravity, as we know it in massless theory, reacts. Okay. And then there is the pi equation, which because of this very special structure of these tensors has also a very special form. Schematically, it has form like this. I'm just writing this schematically without indices here. You can always restore indices. This is just to demonstrate the point. So that's a system of equations you need to solve. Now, let me show you immediately that there is a self-accelerated, what's called a self-accelerated solution. That is the De Sitter solution in which you don't need to introduce any external team you knew. And that comes about as follows. In the second equation, you just satisfy these parentheses. Okay? So there is always a choice, pi equals to some constant times x alpha squared. Okay? So that all the terms here give you constants, because they are always second derivatives of pi. That's what it's always second derivative of pi that enters. Hence, these are constants. And for any given parameter of your theory, a2, a3, you can always find q, which would be a solution, so that this is nullified. But then this is nullified, then you should take this pi and calculate its x mu nu, which is energy momentum of tensor, and you will find out that x mu nu of pi solution is just eta mu nu times lambda 3 cube.
Don't your expressions of q has to be real, which is a restriction on a2 and a3?
Right, of course. There will be a range of parameters for which this works. Not only, yeah, because of that, what you're saying, as well as because of the fact that I want to get here a positive number for it to be De Sitter, not under De Sitter, as well as the stability of the fluctuations. We studied the stability of the fluctuations, and it imposes some bounds. So I should say that this part of the work was done with Claudia, Lavinia Heisenberg, and David Pitts-Halauer. So then you get the De Sitter space. So if you were to write down metric, it looks like this. This is just the De Sitter space in some conformal coordinates. Like this. So once again, to reiterate, this is a true solution. You can claim that this is a true solution for scales shorter than 1 over m. Whether it's true, you know, at 1 over m beyond, you have to do the full theory. So at this stage, that's a statement. And moreover, you can study, or we have to study fluctuations. So I won't go into details of this. Fluctuations are subtle because they have these nonlinear terms, etc. And as Itai was saying, the requirement of the absence of the Gauss in those fluctuations imposes further condition what your A2 and A3 can be. Okay, so there is a broad, you know, it's like half space for each parameter for which this is a solution, De Sitter solution with stable fluctuations. Now, yes.
Is the linear approximation, does it implicitly require pi to be small?
D squared pi has to be small. That's a condition because that's what gravity reacts to. Yeah, not pi itself. Yeah. There is one very interesting point in this self-accelerated on this self-accelerated solution, which will have some manifestation in the case of a black hole, as surprising as it may sound, and that's the following. Remember, before I argued that in order to decouple this helicity zero state from matter, we had to have nonlinear terms. Here, looks like there is another mechanism of decoupling this helicity zero state, and the mechanism is this. So pi, as before, as in the Fitts-Pauli case, doesn't have its own kinetic term. Its kinetic term came from the mixing of h mu nu with this piece. When we diagonalize, that's where it came from. Now, on the background, on this non-trivial background like this, the linear mixing between h mu nu and pi is getting contributions from all terms, x1, x2, and x3. Because for sure in x3, I can saturate two capital pi's by the background, and I have only one pi, and same for x2. So the coefficient in front of the linear mixing between pi and h, so if I may write this way, this would be like fluctuation of pi. So let me call it pi equals to pi classical plus phi. And then I will have this, okay, for the fluctuation, where this term is determined by all x1, x2, and x3. And by the structure of this equation, you see that that coefficient is nothing but this parenthesis. It's just definition of equation of motion pi because of the structure. And that means that when I've satisfied the parenthesis equals to zero, I've also killed this mixing between phi and h. So that means that I don't have to diagonalize anymore. Pi gets its own kinetic term from the backgrounds of h, and there is no mixing between h and phi. So that means that there is no coupling of this phi to matter. So I don't have to worry about it. So this would be an analogy of Brunswicki theory in which the Brunswicki scalar just doesn't couple to matter. It exists by itself, so it's all okay. So in this case, you don't even need to go through this nonlinear story. And from this you can say that it's a specific feature, very specific feature of the self-accelerated background. No other background can do that because this has to be zero, and this has to be zero has a solution which is the self-accelerated background. It doesn't have the flat solution, for instance. So again, I'll come back to this point in some interpretation in a black hole case. All right, so that's the self-accelerated part. Now, let me mention some disappointing part of this, or semi-disappointing. I mentioned that this theory is a way Weinberg's no-go theorem for the big cosmological constant, and actually enable you to cancel the big lambda that you may have introduced due to particle physics, you know, vacuum energies or the fluctuation contributions. So it does the job. So what I mean by that is that if I postulate on the right-hand side of the equation, let me call it lambda cc. So that's at least TV to the fourth divided by M Planck squared, or higher, okay? Then there exists a solution in which space is Minkowski. And that you can see very easily from the second equation. Now I choose a solution on which h mu equals zero, as it should be for Minkowski. So then the second equation is automatically satisfied no matter what pi. And I choose pi, again, to be some q tilde divided by x mu squared, so that this exactly compensates for the big cosmological constant. So what happens physically is that you have this other field, the pi, which has its own energy momentum tensor, and it adjusts. On this solution, it just adjusts to the big cosmological constant, compensates. Now that would have been great if everything worked with this solution.
But is it just in pi, or it just like this is the solution
that was? Yeah. So at the moment, that's where we stopped. Of course, we should address that question, but there is other issue, and that's why we stopped. And let me explain what the issue is. Now you look at this solution, and you study fluctuations about it. Fluctuations are stable again for very broad range of A2 and A3. But the point is that
stable in the decoupling limit, or beyond?
In the decoupling limit. So far I'm talking about the decoupling limit. Actually, in the full theory as well, there is no reason to expect that they are stable. But the issue is that now this is not a self-accelerated solution anymore. Hence, you have to have this nonlinear screening mechanism that I described before. But all those nonlinear terms, if you write down now the nonlinear terms for this fluctuation of pi, they come out suppressed not by this little lambda, by some lambda effective, which depends on the cosmological constant that you screened. Okay, so this lambda effective is a function of lambda cc. And when your cosmological constant is large, Tb to the fourth divided by M Planck square, this scale is very large. And so that means that you don't get this Weinstein mechanism till very short scales. Hence your theory is ruled out by solar system measurements. So you do get fifth force on this background. Okay, so that is why, so it's interesting that the way it's Weinberg theorem but goes wrong in, you know, in terms of comparison with observations.
So we actually like Tb to the fourth over M Planck squared is no good. So
yeah, yeah,
that's, maybe the electron balls.
Yes, it goes down to that, yes, unfortunately. Yeah. If it were if at least one GV to the fourth, I'd be happy too.
Right.
But it doesn't work that
so
way.
So electron balls.
Yeah. So for which you don't need to screen. Yeah, so but what this suggests is that maybe something along these lines. At least this is a model in which you can await the very strong, you know, objection. The novel theory is a very strong objection how you could be solving the problem. So this type of theory is awaited. Yes, please.
This might just be a detail, but why do you write A to mu nu there and not G mu nu?
If
A is to be a solution, then they're the same, but when you're perturbing it, then it makes it
different. Right, because I'm in this decoupling limit. In the decoupling limit, M Planck goes to infinity. And what's remaining is just this part.
Yes.
But this solution exists in the full theory as well. So if I write the full theory, that's a legitimate thing to do in the decoupling limit. Because this corresponds to scales much shorter than inverse M. And then I'm looking at the Minkowski space. And any realistic cosmology is a small departure from the Minkowski space as long as I'm away from.
Would it make any difference if you wrote little g there instead of a?
Yeah, I don't have a notion of little g in this limit.
And what is capital? What is the Einstein tensor in that limit?
This is a linearized Einstein tensor.
Just linearized.
Yes, that's why I said linearized.
Oh,
right. But there is a full theory solution of this.
But it's true that it's really premature to tell what you solve cosmological because the essence of that would be you would just whatever your words are, you write some theory down. And you say how big your quantum corrections are, and you say what your whole calculation is, and you put the electron in, and you make some choices that make things flat, and then you start integrating out stuff.
Yeah,
right? So it's suggestive that the cosmological constant term drops out. That's something which has to happen in particular. But that's not sufficient, right?
No. About that point, this is kind of pretty clear, because not, here we're discussing scales which are cosmological. So at those scales, I'll integrate.
Those are not the dangerous ones for the cosmological constant, right? It's a very short wavelength.
Oh, no. So at those scales, I'll integrate it out all the short scales.
Yeah, but the assertion you're making is that they only appear at lambda cc.
Yes, of course.
But to really know that, we have to have a theory at the ultraviolet scale where we have the part we integrate it out, and we could actually see if everywhere the quantum corrections went in, and we know how big they were.
No, that doesn't matter. All of them are here. What I'm saying is that, okay, let's say you have. Well. Because I assume the arbitrary value for this. If I had low energy supersymmetry, this would be Tb to the, I assume the maximal value. This would be Tb to the fourth divided by M Planck square. If I didn't have low energy supersymmetry, this could be M Planck square.
Everything I'm worried about is I know other examples, a bigger example, where you integrate out some particle of mass M, and you start looking at effective operators, then they're not suppressed by the Planck scale. They're suppressed, normally if they're suppressed by the smallest scale that you integrate out. So if you start integrating electrons, you get all kinds of effective operators that depend on them in all kinds of funny ways.
Sure.
And then you want to run everything down to extremely small scales and show that there's nothing ruined to the flatness that you arrange in the solution.
Right.
And it may happen here, but it seems like you can't tell yet.
I can, because there is one operator, which is the cosmological constant, and there is a contribution to that operator coming from all kinds of UV physics. So I'll combine all of them here.
Your assumption is that that's all that comes in from UV physics, that one off.
Well, there are higher dimensional operators as well, suppressed by some scales, but those are not the terms that we call cosmological constant. I mean,
they're often dangerous for cosmological constant problems in the sense that.
If you assign some vacuum expectation value for those fields, they will give you something which is a cosmological constant. So I'll put in it all those things. In other words, all the operators that I have in this language are operators for fluctuations or departures from equilibrium state. While equilibrium state gives you all kinds of contributions in this. Could be, you know, Higgs vacuum energy, or could be QCD condensates, or could be gut scale.
Could be curvature. I know specific theories which are kind of less broke than this, for which if you had just, you know, it'd be very tempting to say that the only thing that open quantum physics contributes to is the cosmological constant. That's certainly very dangerous. But to be sure that you've actually got tall enough to agree with the observed cosmological constant, you actually have to show that that's not contributing and that the subdominant things are also not contributing. You have to work your way down the list of operators.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that even if you, not even, you should allow for all those things to be contributing, then you should be taking the maximum value and then trying to solve it. And that's, as long as you solve it for arbitrary value, that's the solution.
That's not sufficient, I don't think. I think what you have to really do is write this theory down.
Yes.
And then start integrating out short distance physics and show.
So I've done it.
Well, so you say, but then you haven't actually
said actually. Okay, so see, here are some other contributions. This is some TMU matter, by which I mean all the standard model. So that standard model fields are fluctuations about their ground states, whatever those ground states may be. To a standard model, I mean loosely, it could be gut scale or you know, gut physics or whatever. So that the vacuum contribution of this TMU is already here. So actually there is a unique way to do that, because if you allow for this kind of thing to kind of inflate for infinite amount of time, this will be the only thing that won't be redshifted away, while everything will be redshifted away. So you can define it that way.
I agree that that's necessary, but if you could really do what you need to do, you'd be able to tell them how they're getting renormalized.
So I've renormalized. This is renormalized value at the scale of Hubble today.
For example, your A2 and A3, how do they normalize?
Oh, so A2 and A3 in this decoupling limit, they just don't renormalize. These are like topology.
All the operators you haven't written down that were suppressed by the scales, how do they normalize? Because the thing is, you have to work to sub-element order.
Hold on. We're discussing a number of different issues simultaneously.
Of
no, but there is a clear statement. There is a clear statement that is there. If I wrote the gravity as it is, as I presented, where, by the way, A2 and A3 are not renormalized in this limit, and then included all kinds of quantum corrections from the particle physics in a consistent way, I can combine all the vacuum contributions in a term that I call cosmological constant. I don't know what is the exact value of the cosmological constant. I only know that, you know, if there is supersymmetry, it protects me about the, let's say, low energy or something like that, but I don't know much about it. So it's some value. Now, the problem is that for that value, which would consider natural, because, say, supersymmetry, to come up with a theory in which curvature will still be zero or nearly zero. That's the problem that I'm addressing. That's a cosmological kind of problem. Because everything else is just departure from the cosmological constant. This of course, could introduce some cosmology.
I would say that's an important part of the cosmological constant problem, but it's not the whole cosmological.
So then I'm not understanding what's the whole thing, because all the whole vacuum energy are included here. This is, if you want, this is, this part is VEV of TMU nu of the world, of particle physics.
That's a particular scale, right? I think
no, even in the scale, this is defined at the scale of, let's say, H0.
Right. That's
a very low energy scale, so I've integrated out everything possible that we know in the UV.
That's
this
the
very
hard part, right? The hard part is the integrating out of that. So you should be able to tell me how to couple this electron, and I should be able to
integrate
the electron.
Oh, come on.
Cliff,
I mean, it couples in the usual way. I said that this couples H mu nu times T mu nu, which is in a, let's say you had a scalar in a generally covariant way. It couples, say to a scalar, it couples this way, or if you want to have a mass term, it couples in the usual way like in GR. There is no difference. So this gravity couples in a conventional, you know, tensorial way to
G related to capital H?
G and capital H are so this was a definition.
This is the thing that presented.
Yeah. that's the relation. So no, that part is conventional.
And on the gravity side, you're probably mixed up before you have a chance to tell us outside of the decoupling limit. But presumably there is, if I did not take the decoupling limit, I just took M to be zero and then Planck to be fixed, I would get general relativity. But I only really would get that if I went past the linearized Einstein term. So there's other things that you haven't written down yet which will be there.
Right.
And so the question would be, you have to write them all down and how they couple to the electron. And then now I start integrating out the electron.
Hold on. But by all you mean, let's be very concrete. By all you mean full nonlinear theory of massive gravity.
Everything.
So I'm about to write that.
Okay, I'll wait for that.
But for this issue, that there is no difference because your electrons couple to massive gravity in identical way as they couple to massless gravity. So in terms of integrating out the UV stuff and writing down the effective operator, all that, this is identical to standard thing that we do in GR.
But what I know is that in examples of standard things in GR where you have a similar thing for classical solutions, you know, energies like that drop out, like tensions of brain and things. But if you actually really want something small enough to be a cosmological constant, you have to actually do better than showing that that's not coming up. That's when you have to show that the subdominant curvature terms are also not there. And so it may be true that that's not true in your theory, but I don't yet see why.
By subdominant, you mean that there could be some crazy time evolution due to this thesis.
Well, you're just making some terms up here, but you really want to see what all the terms are. Because the whole essence of the problem is, is that nothing that's for you, it's not the things you choose to write down.
No, I think to be complete, I think I've listed all the terms here.
Well, for example, the nonlinear part of G mu nu.
Oh yeah, so I have to write, you know, it's enough to show it in this limit, and then justifying the full theory, which I'm going to write the full theory. So what I'm saying is that there is a full theory. Let me write it because. Yes, please.
Don't answer this if you're about to answer it with a full theory, but I'm still thinking about the question I asked. So even in linear terms, you should put A to mu nu plus H mu nu, or whatever the linearized gravity.
That would be the next order correction, because this theory, this approach is just expansion of any FRW cosmology along the flat.
Yes.
And then H itself is of order small. If I had the small number here, that would be, you know, square of the small. So that's the next order. So it's,
but why is it smaller than the G mu nu linear?
Because if I had a small instance, the simplest case is this. This part, this big part is compensated by this big part.
Yes.
Okay. Now I have some smaller parts which come from, you know, matter, radiation, etc. Now those small parts are the ones that excite little h. They
yes.
depart h from zero. So that means that h itself is of order of that small number. Now
yes.
the next term here would be kind of t times that h, so that would be square of that small number.
But also the little h times lambda cc.
Little h times lambda cc, that's taking care of nonlinear pieces in here. Because there are corrections of that order to this part as well, which are decoupled. But I'm about to write the full thing, which we'll see that it's identical. So is there a theory that gives rise in the decoupling limit all these structures, and then it's good beyond it? So answer is yes. Let me write down the theory. Of course, from here it won't be obvious that it's all good, but. So U2 of K plus alpha 3 U3 of K plus alpha 4 U4 of K. Okay, where this U2, U3, and U4 are cousins of U's that I had before, and U2 is K mu nu K mu nu minus k alpha beta squared, which again, in terms of epsilon, I can write this way. Now I'm not going to do contractions. It's the standard way that I showed before. U3 is, there is an expression in terms of k, but this is epsilon, epsilon, k, k, k. And then there is U4, which is epsilon, epsilon, k, 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 where k mu nu is a very special matrix. It's maybe right here. Okay? So there is a matrix. So this is a matrix. Okay? So this is a square root of the matrix, which means the square of that is just the matrix. Alright? So this is delta mu nu minus that. So this sign is fixed by the requirement that k in the lowest order starts with little h to get the Fritz Pauli Lagrangian, as you see. Otherwise, this is some complicated nonlinear expression. And u2, u3, and u4 are those, as I said, cousins of all those total derivatives. Basically, these terms are obtained by taking those total derivatives and replacing capital P mu nu by k mu nu. So it's just dressing up that limit, which guarantees that in the decoupling limit, you get exactly what I told you. So it's a covariant theory.
Is this choice of k mu nu unique?
Yes, that choice of k mu nu is unique with the requirement for not having a tadpoles. There is a solution of quadratic equation. There is another solution with a plus as well, but that won't start with little h to have a constant, so that will give rise to tadpole. Of course, I could have introduced, you know, tadpole itself to cancel that, but it's equivalent to. So in that modulo that, it's unique. So then you have these two parameters, alpha 3 and alpha 4, which are functions of C3 and D5 that I described before.
Your alphas are indistinguishable from your functions.
Yes, thank you. Alphas have indices, like Lagrangian doesn't. Yeah. All right. I don't know. Okay. And that's it. Of course, you can write again, this is going along the eta expression, U1, which is linear in K, but that will have a tadpole, and for that you would have to introduce cosmological constant to cancel it. But if you not including cosmological constant, then these are the only terms that you can write. Now, equation of motion, going back to your question, equation of motion has this structure, except that now I have to remove linearized, and this will be the full-fledged x mu nu of these phis. And you are, of course, right that this will be g mu nu in front of the, if I had the cosmological constant.
Is that in your accounting already, or do we have to add
one? Yeah, you have to add this plus Lagrangian of the particle physics, say, standard model. So which may include cosmological constant and everything else. And so you have also t mu nu of the or the particle physics. So that's a full theory. And then there is the equation for phis, which is analog of this equation that I wrote before, which in fact is nothing but the, if you just have written this equation and, you know, applied covariant derivatives, you would have gotten the Bianchi identity for this part. And in this language, the equation of motion for phis is just this Bianchi identity. Okay, so let me put m squared in front here.
But there are four phis, so you need four equations.
Yes, they. You're right. There are four phis. If I take they factorize basically in this way because. So let's see.
So these are also four equations, you're saying?
Right, that's right.
Okay,
so those are
the,
yeah. Right.
But one question, is it obvious that the matrix only has positive eigenvalues?
Well, the ones, you can have some field, well, if around four departures of flat space, this has a positive eigenvalue, it's constructed, that's why one index is up and
sure,
down. You can have field configurations for which this would tend to flip the sign, and then they are not just they're just not solutions of your theory. They exist such things. For instance, we've seen that you solve far away from a source, and then you're coming in, and then it starts to flip the sign, which means that's not a solution, and you look for another one, which doesn't do that. I want to, instead of doing repeating what I said in terms of cosmology which all those solutions that I mentioned go through here with some minor modifications at the scale of the Hubble, and that by itself is interesting, but it's a whole subject. And probably I should do black holes a little bit because that I haven't mentioned. And then if you have questions, I'll be happy to discuss the full cosmology.
Before you leave this,
yes.
What's the maximum scale that you trust this? So what's your kind of
classically or quantum mechanically?
Either.
Classically, this is true until M Planck, because there are operators like R squared and R cubed down by M Planck. Now, quantum mechanically,
if you take the standalone model thing and I integrate out the electron, I'll get curvature squared with the electron mass, or cubed with the electron.
Yeah, but that's because you integrated out the electron and you know what's the completion of it. You know? So if I have QED, right, and I integrate out electrons, I'm going to get the Euler Heisenberg Lagrangian.
Right.
Clearly, it looks like effective Lagrangian, but I know what's the UV completion of that Lagrangian, which is QED.
So when you say that it goes up to the Planck scale, you're assuming there's nothing between this three?
I'm saying that this is a full theory. There is a standard model, this is a very low scale theory, and there is a standard model, which is a high scale, which has high scales in it.
It's not normalizable, so...
Right, so quantum mechanics, that's why I'm saying classically versus quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanically, there is this alpha quantum effective that I discussed. There is effective scale, which is determined by the lambda, which is very, very low, and the typical curvatures that you are considering. And the best I can do for, you know, realistic world is... By choosing some this alpha 3 and alpha 4 in not too big a tuning, but you know, order of magnitude choices to make it compatible with the scales at which gravity has been measured, like microns and stuff like this. That will be the quantum scale beyond which I don't know what this theory does. It has to have some understanding beyond that, whether it's UV completion or whatever it is, that I don't know.
That scale was the lambda 3 scale.
It's a lambda 3, combination of lambda 3 and the classical scale that I'm looking at. For instance, if I'm looking at early cosmology, that scale is very, very high because of the backgrounds. If I'm looking today, that scale is, for instance, if I'm looking at a solar system, that scale will be determined by lambda 3 and curvatures in the solar system.
So if I was a skeptic and I said, I'm going to take your Lagrangian and I'm going to start adding random functions of gamma, okay, say.
Yeah, you get the Boulevard Desert Ghost. That's where we started. So.
Well, but I'm going to say, well, since this is an effective theory, the only way I understand how to do quantum mechanics with effective theory is I take all possible operators, I suppress them by some scale, and I'll just say so there's some scale above which I cannot go.
Right. If you adopt
to be lower than the scale you said.
Right. So if you adopt that point of view, then this would require some tunings at the scale. The quantum theory would require some tunings at the scale of this lambda effective that I mentioned. And if I do the tuning by introducing counter terms, by which I cancel certain bad terms, then it's perfectly fine. You can do that, but it requires that tuning.
So in a sense, tuning in the sense that if I don't make your choice, then I'll start to, or even if I do make your choice, I'll start to run away from that choice.
By tuning, I mean that if I don't make these choices, then you're gonna get back this Boulevard Desert Ghost at the scale of this lambda effective, because you generate.
What if I say if that's a scale that's high, I'm going to have that physics. It's effective theory. So
it's not very high. That's a point. It's not very high. It's not, you know, I told you best I can do is by choosing this coefficient, like a micron scales I can do, but it's not very high.
Yeah.
So it requires understanding beyond that scale.
I guess what I'm probing towards is if I wanted to ask the one question, about anything else,
right.
Then the only way I know how to phrase it is in this kind of theory, once you've done normalizable is as an effective theory. So that means that I really do have a scale which I've been in the energy limit for.
Yeah, sure.
And then at least I can ask the question
very
concretely in that.
Yeah, for that question, I think I answered already. The scale at which you should be thinking of this as effective scale, effective theory is this lambda effective, which is a combination of lambda square root of. So this square pi zero and pi classical is a representative of the. Representative of the curvature scales. I can rewrite this in terms of inwari, this is just for simplicity. This would be your effective scale of your quantum theory. And beyond this scale, I mean, shorter distances, I have to complete this theorem, which I don't know what the completion is.
Well, I guess so one question would be that that is a scale, but there's probably another scale which doesn't involve pi classical that is also in the top. Just because it will depend on what I interpret. But supposing I say fine, let's just take that scale. If I ask the question, the things that you did not write down, how do they run? Do they run kind of in
well, yeah, I think, okay, so the A2 and A3 that I told you, there is a non-randomization theorem for them.
In the
decoupling limit. That means that whatever corrections they get has to be suppressed by extra powers of little n so that they vanish in the decoupling limit. That guarantees that in your effective field theory, your wide effective theory, which I claim, you never get ghost below the scale that I claim.
Well, one question I would have there is that if I have other scales in the problem, like the probabilistic scales,
yes.
If I only had two scales, I knew what the coupling limit was, because you told me how the m goes to zero and n prime goes to infinity.
Yes.
But if I have other scales, what do I do with them? Do I have to start adjusting them in the coupling limit too, or are they fixed?
Well, it depends which scale. I mean, particle physics, you can separate the issues and treat particle physics separately as you prefer. If I want to have sensitivity to what the particle physics does, I have to take particle physics T mu nu goes to infinity artificially just to have sensitivity to it. Otherwise, it just decouples from this theory. So what I'm suggesting is that there is no trouble there. Keep your scales in the particle physics as you prefer, and then it decouples from this gravity. What happens is that there is a kind of nonlinear interaction within gravity sector itself, which are kind of secluded from those scales. Unless you want, of course, to crank up those scales too to probe the sensitivity of gravity in response to you know particle physics.
But it sounds like then the difference between the full calculation and the decoupled calculation involves inverse powers of large scales, and that could have been M Planck, but it could also have been particle physics massive, because those were also very large.
No.
So it might be one of the quantum mass problems.
The decoupling limit is just defined by the two scales that I introduced.
Well, but we just had a conversation about what we do with the Tannenbaum scale.
But they have nothing to do with the helicity, so the mass of gravity. These are separate scales, electric. So in the part, okay, click. So let's say we have in the world just mass of gravity and QED for simplicity and concreteness, right? So in QED you have M electron, okay? And now you are saying that I want to be at the scales below M electron, which is very appropriate for the cosmology. Sure, you integrate down your M electron. So you've got this, whatever it is, 4. That's your effective Lagrangian. Mm-hmm. And this is your scale. So now you do with this whatever you like to do. That's not affecting what I said about the gravity part.
So what I'm essentially worried about is the feedback between this, you know, there's two questions. One would be if you had no standard model, you just had your gravity theory, and I started doing quantum corrections, how much do I ruin what you wrote down? And the second part of the question would be now I add something else like the standard model and ask
right.
The same question.
Oh, so
there'll be scales involved in it, but I don't see yet what scales they should be.
Right. So certainly the standard model. So these structures which are specifically chosen, are potentially renormalized by gravity loops as well as the standard model loops. Okay, but what I was saying is that in the decoupling limit, these structures are topological, so they don't get renormalized. Hence, whatever renormalization you get from idle loops have to scale with powers of m gravity. Loop can have in it standard model
part. Well,
that,
it doesn't have to be m gravity. It could be 1 over 1 of the scales that you took to be very large, right?
No.
But that's okay, because these are the lowest scales in the universe that I'm discussing. Anything in particle physics is much higher scale. It's I've dealt with it, you know. I can, in a Lewisonian sense, I can integrate out the particle physics. Period. There is no particle physics at this scale. I've integrated out. So all I have is some effective operators suppressed by scales which are way high by the standards that I'm discussing here, including electron mass, including neutrino mass.
Well, that's the question, though, right? So the thing is that what you'd like to do is you'd like to understand as you start integrating out physics with other scales than the ones you started with.
So
I run RG.
So here is the. So let me keep gravity as an external field. Although I can start talking about its loops later on. It is a partition function, and here is the psi standard model into the I S standard model, the function of J and G nu, right? So that's the partition function. Now, I run in a Wilsonian sense this down to scales in which I only have, nothing but just the massless modes, maybe photon. Just so this psi contains photon in it, so this is B photon e to the I S effective, which has only massless modes, and J G. That's it. So all the other scales, all the massive guys, the electrons, neutrinos, they're massive. I've integrated them out. Because
is there any effective around you controlling all your effective operators?
This is the effective, of course. I have these operators. This was what I was referring to.
All kinds, right?
Yep.
We're all there.
Yep.
So the thing is that, so now we've got those scales, like M electron in the problem, we've got Planck in the problem, we've got lambda in the problem, we've got lambda in the problem. So now I look at the non decoupling limit fractions, and I some of them could be partial to M, because M could be 0 is one of the limits. But also they could be partial to 1 over Planck, because that's also part of the decoupling limit.
Yeah.
They could be 1 over M electron.
Yeah.
But so the generic, they're all there, it sounds like. All those scales would be.
Cool.
Yes.
And
they don't need to be suppressed by the
massive. Oh yeah, they are suppressed either in little m but inverse m Planck, which is equivalent in this case because I can translate one into the other. I fix capital lambda, right, which is a product of little m.
I think he's mostly concerned about the other scales, but I don't think it's scale of the other scales.
No, but
so
the other scales don't
it's
matter.
They
just don't matter. You see, I integrated out everything. I don't have any other scale here. I've just integrated out.
Well, that they're there, but they're in your effective operator. Right?
Yeah, but the irrelevant operators in the infrared, they don't matter.
Depends on the question you ask. And the cosmological constant problem in particular, they can't matter.
No, because all the backgrounds. So now we're saying, okay, let's say this photon has some background. That's fine. I just take that background and extract the constant piece of this and include that in my lambda CC. And as long as I keep it generic, allowing for everything to contribute in it and solve the problem for it, I'm fine.
I know examples where that's actually a false statement.
And because of what?
Because the thing is that you need to have that.
Yes.
But the basic cosmological constant has to grab the curvature. But the curvature, what you're asking is that the cosmological constant is so incredibly small compared to TV scale,
yeah,
that you have to check that subdominant terms in your effective expansion that are suppressed
sure,
by the
sure.
TV scale,
that small. Yeah, that I call conventional cosmology. That means that there are gradient terms, there could be gradient terms, which drive other type of cosmological expansion, which is not allowed by observations, right?
But in the only example I know where you can actually do this explicitly, it's a false statement to say that the cosmological constant making it droplet is sufficient. So it may be that something a miracle happens here, but the case has to be made for it.
No, I don't think so. This is a universal statement because I separated T mu. You gave me, let's say you have some field theory, any pulse, whatever, four finite theory in the UV. You gave me that theory and you told me here is how supersymmetry is broken. Right? I can, and here is the particle physics content. And I can calculate, everything. I can calculate everything in that theory. Then I separate two pieces. One is the constant piece, definition of which is that if I allowed universe to inflate forever due to this piece, everything else would be redshifted away. So I define it that way. And then there are corrections which could give you some other types of radiation, matter. Sure, but I'm solving the cosmological constant problem, which is this problem.
Well, that's part of the problem. Right? So that the issue is. The issue is
well, probably we should
you're coupling, essentially you're coupling curvature of the universe, and yeah, you're saying the first term is zero, which is good, and you have to make that zero to make it work. But then you have to show that it's...
There's a consistent cosmology.
You have to show how big the fractions were to your calculation made it zero to see how
well, they're there. Well, there's a consistent cosmology, of course. And of course I'm going to do it in a usual FRW way, but... Let me comment on this.
So why are we discussing this? I think you said that you're not solving the cosmological constant.
Well, still,
so,
it's an interesting question. It's a matter of concept. If I were to solve this problem, there would be a solution. And the reason, why is because you see, for instance, what do we do? What do we do when we don't have a solution for cosmological constant? So, but we fine tune it. Right? And the way we fine-tune it is that we do it once by choosing the inflationary potential. Because if legendary potential could have been like this, with huge scale, like Tb to the fourth, that would give rise to zero temperature curvature, which would be unacceptable. So we tune this down to whatever we want here. And that's it. That's enough for subsequent cosmology to be consistent with what we see. That's the only one fine-tuning that we do. Otherwise, it will be a disaster that we would have to fine-tune at every stage and we'll look at all the gradient terms. The cosmology is such that once I fine-tune this, because this is a zero temperature curvature, then everything else that goes through conventional FRW cosmology won't generate anything new in that regard.
Okay, I'm going to say one last thing, because I know I'm just But I think that it's necessary but not sufficient. The thing is that
you have to
know something you haven't told us yet, which is that if you took L, the real L of the world, to be your L plus corrections, you know how big the corrections are and how they scale with all the scales of the problem.
The same question exists in the GR, and I think the answer is this. So you're saying that in conventional GR with tuned inflationary potential, we don't know cosmology. And I think we know. We measure. I think that's the difference between what you are saying and what I'm saying.
So we're not
officially over time.
I'm happy to discuss this, but
this is kind of a general question. I mean, what you've done, if I understand it at all, is you've taken general relativity and then you've defined some new variables. And you've taken a special gauge choice of those new variables, and you kind of found a new result that somehow it looks different from general relativity. But I'm kind of wondering, I mean, in terms of the old idea of Borchers classes in quantum field theory, it doesn't matter what kind of redefinition of your fields you make, you always get the same old thing back, unless you take some singular limit.
Took just a gauge. This is a physical change within general relativity.
Where exactly is the change?
Here. This is the additional piece in your Einstein equation, and no matter what gauge you choose, this is non-zero. I mean, generically it's non-zero. So it generically gives you departures from GR. The reason why, never mind that, I mean, my graviton propagates with speed less than a flat space with less than c, because it's got mass.
So from a general point of view, what is it that you've done? I mean, there must be a simple explanation for
that. Okay, what I've done is that the GR has 2 degrees of freedom, helicity degrees of freedom. When graviton in GR propagates on flat space, it has 2 helicity states, plus minus 2 states. This theory has 5 helicity states. That's the simplest way. And that was a challenge so far, because usually 6 degrees of freedom would come up, but not in this theory. So that's a classical theory which gives you 5 degrees of freedom. So that's what we've done. and then you can take it from there and ask all kinds of questions, which we are asking, and
it seems to me that strictly to the classical theory is open control. I mean, you look at points of gravity. A lot of people are trying to solve it still for years. The G mean you have already, GR is, as we all know, non-normalizable. Now you have M squared X mu, which makes it even more non-normalizable, so to speak. Because now you have cross fields from the scale. So what you're saying is that if you cut all that stuff out, and I don't like non-normalizable, I have a classical theory which I can apply for all practical purposes and not get into any experimental problems with cosmology and so on. So in that case, why do we worry about finding a renormalizable quantum gravity theory? There's no point.
So we need to understand short distance physics, and there are cosmological singularities and there are singularities in the black holes. We'd like to understand them, and that's what, at least that's why we would need quantum gravity. So that's a short answer. I mean, I could go on and on, but
you can't solve these problems.
No, I don't claim that. I mean, this needs UV completion.
Wrong at the time.
One problem at a time. That's right. So there was a question, but I only want to talk about black holes, but probably there's no time. But okay, I'll take.
I was going to ask. I was just going to try to go direct to black holes. So I just want to hear about black holes. Yeah, that's great.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So, yeah. So we are officially over. But that's, so if anyone wants to leave, there, this is a free country, of course.